Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Good morning to everybody in the Valley Forge area and everyone out in internet land. Welcome to We the People, the Constitution Matters. I'm your host, Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative, and I have with me this morning my two intrepid commentators, David Whitney, Senior Instructor at the Institute on the Constitution, and Phil Duffy, Instructor at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. Last week we looked at when governments kill, and specifically whether it was proper or a violation of constitutional rights for our government to execute American citizen Anwar al-Awlaki in a drone strike in Yemen in 2011. Other Americans have also been killed in this so-called war on terror that some are calling our 100 years war. Are we comfortable as a people with our government deciding which of us gets his or her right of due process and which of us does not? I think it's an issue we need to continue talking about. Unfortunately, there are many more topics that also deserve our attention. So this week, we're going to turn to an equally controversial topic and one that will no doubt affect far more of our citizens than the last one. What happens when governments take? When is it proper or not proper for governments to take private property? To what uses can that property be fairly put? And who decides what is just compensation? We'll also discuss some of the recent abuses of what we commonly call eminent domain. We'll be taking your calls later in the show, and I encourage you to call in. Like I said, this subject could affect anyone who owns property. The primary call-in number is 610-539-TALK. That's 610-539-8255. If the primary number is busy, we have alternate numbers of 610-539-1783 and 1784. All first-time callers today will receive in the mail a nifty pocket constitution. My supply of these is starting to stack up, so I'm hoping to get rid of one or two today. So let's get started, as we usually do, by examining what the Constitution has to say on this matter, and we'll be focusing on the last clause of the Fifth Amendment, normally called the Takings Clause. It reads, "Nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation." Notice that the Constitution assumes the government has the power to take property to start with, and this clause only places some restrictions when that power is exercised. But you're going to search in vain for an enumerated power in the Constitution to take private property. And that's one of the problems we'll be discussing. Where did government get this power in the first place? We'll also be discussing what is property, what is public use, and what is just compensation. But first I'm going to turn to my friend Phil Duffy. Phil is currently teaching a course at Osher called Profiles in Healing, which examines the process and results when former enemies reconcile, which somehow reminds me of the reconciliation that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams went through in the early 1800s after becoming estranged due to their time spent as president and vice president of America. That's a bit off topic perhaps, but still, and it's an amazing thing to read about. Phil, give us your view of what happens when governments take.
Well, Gary, when governments take is too broad a subject to cover in an hour here. I'd better narrow my comments. I won't be talking about taxation, which is the most obvious example of governments taking from the people. And I won't be talking about inflation, which is when governments take our wealth in a stealthier manner by destroying the value of our currency. And finally, I won't be talking about slavery, when governments take everything we have. I'm going to limit myself to what are called takings under Amendment 5 of the Constitution. Remember that this amendment is part of the first 10, the Bill of Rights, and that the Bill of Rights were created to protect individual liberty. And specifically, I'll be commenting on that provision of Amendment 5, which states, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. So we all have a sense of private property. It's what we own. So at first blush, the intent of this amendment should be absolutely clear, right? Not so fast, say the justices of the Supreme Court in the 2005 Kelo versus New London opinion. What people might consider public use and those men and women in black robes consider public use are very different concepts. For the people, public use means schools, parks, roads, hospitals, that sort of thing. We can all acknowledge that even these examples of public use projects offer some opportunities for corruption by public officials. We have roads and bridges to nowhere, for example. But that sort of thing aside, most of us are willing to concede that governments need the power to seize private property if we recognize the truly public need of the project. But that's not what Kelo versus New London was about. Kelo was about the creation of a new meaning for public use. Perhaps the majority of the Supreme Court justices were inspired by Napoleon's acknowledgement in George Orwell's Animal Farm that certainly all animals were equal, but that some were more equal than others. And they definitely ignored Emerson's advice when he said, the corruption of man is followed by the corruption of language. Did I get that backwards? It seems to make sense both ways.
Yep.
Here is the essence of that opinion, or if you prefer, rationalization. Though the city could not take petitioner's land simply to confer a private benefit on a particular private private party, the takings at issue here would be executed pursuant to a carefully considered development plan, which was not adopted to benefit particular class of identifiable individuals. So what was this development plan? The Wikipedia article for the case states the following. Pardon me. Kelo versus City of New London was a case decided by the Supreme Court of the United States involving the use of eminent domain to transfer land from one private owner to another private owner to further economic development. In a 5-4 decision, the court held that the general benefits a community enjoyed from economic growth qualified private redevelopment plans as permissible public use under the Takings Clause of the Fifth Amendment. Note that the economic growth need not be demonstrated or guaranteed. It was necessary, it was not necessary, for politicians to do anything more than have what could be considered an economic growth moment or like a general welfare moment, just something that fleeted through their minds. So in theory, behind the theory behind Kelo versus New London was that it was just a take from Peter to give to Paul because somehow everybody might benefit from that thievery. And I'm not going to use the euphemism taken because it covers a multitude of sins here. All that was necessary to justify the thievery was that a private individual submit a redevelopment plan that promised growth. And the five justices who signed on to this distortion of justice were Stevens, Souter, Kennedy, Ginsburg, and Breyer, in case you wish to pin their pictures on your personal dartboards. And with that so-called legal precedent was established. And the neat thing about the men who framed the original Constitution and the Bill of Rights was that in spite of their human limitations, they somehow rose above petty politics to recognize the need for a system of government that somehow checked the downside of human nature. Separation of powers was designed to inhibit corruption, and checks and balances augmented that basic principle. Kelo versus New London on the other hand, trashes those constitutional concepts and creates the Wild West of property ownership. Public official, how shall I corrupt thee? Let me count the ways. The story doesn't really end there. Multiple state assemblies have passed laws placing a leash on Kelo versus New London. But most remarkable, however, is the outcome of the New London Development Project. Here's a reading of that outcome. In spite of repeated efforts, the redeveloper, who stood to get a 91-acre waterfront tract of land for $1 per year, was unable to obtain financing, and the redevelopment project was abandoned. As for the beginning, as of the beginning of 2010, the original Kelo property was a vacant lot, generating no tax revenue for the city. In the aftermath of 2011's Hurricane Irene, the now closed New London development was turned into a dump for storm debris such as tree branches and other vegetation. And as of February 2014, it was still vacant. Pfizer, whose employees were supposed to be the clientele of the Fort Trumbull redevelopment project, as it was called, completed its merger with Wyeth, resulting in a consolidation of research facilities of the two companies. Pfizer chose to retain the Groton campus on the east side of the Thames River, closing its New London facility in late 2010 with the loss of over 1,000 jobs. That coincided with the expiration of tax breaks on the New London site that would have increased Pfizer's property tax bill by almost 400%. Notice that I haven't mentioned the other part of the Amendment 5 analysis, what is just compensation. That's a far more difficult topic, and I would probably require a lot more time to cover that. But I know I'm sounding like a broken record on this subject, but public use is just one more term in the Constitution that needs to be formally defined, along with general welfare and interstate commerce that we mentioned last week. I am not usually sympathetic to those who criticize the Constitution simply because it is over 200 years old. But okay, today I'll acknowledge in this case that those critics have a point. We've had over 200 years of experience with the Constitution, an experience made visible by generations of some of the worst political scoundrels to bring cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. Think of how many of those senseless cases that could have been eliminated by properly defining legal terms used in our Constitution.
Well, you're absolutely right, and thanks for that rundown on Kelo. It, we normally look at the Kelo as the poster child of improper takings. But, and even though a lot of people were shocked at the Kelo decision, I know I certainly was, I should point out that there were definitely some constitutional scholars who feel that Kelo was rightly decided, that public benefit was indeed the founder's view of the phrase public use, and the citizens of the city of New London were going to benefit, according to the plan, eventually through some tax revenue and increased tax revenue. The fact that the deal fell through and the land sits idle today, generating no revenue whatsoever, shows the folly of the city's plan, not necessarily the rectitude or the rightness of the court's decision. But whether Kelo was rightly decided or not, it had immense implications, and they were immediately apparent. It could have opened the floodgates to similar takings on flimsy public benefit grounds, and the decision implied it would be constitutional for governments to take property and just pass it on to developers if they merely thought that the property might generate profit. So this potential primarily led 44 states, as you point out, to including my own state of Virginia, to enact restrictions on themselves and their local governments. 11 of those states, including Virginia, passed a constitutional amendment which prohibits localities from taking private property for, and I'll quote, private enterprise, job creation, tax revenue generation, or economic development. So at least the citizens of Virginia are protected from the implications of Kelo versus City of New London. And as are other states. So here's a perfect example of the states protecting their citizens. I only wish it happened more often. There are certainly many more opportunities for the states to step in. I think it was Virginia's constitutional amendment which put into limbo a long-standing eminent domain fight going on right across the James River from me here in Norfolk, Virginia. And if we have some time towards the end, we may get into more detail on that. Now, our listeners can find out if their state did or did not restrict its use of eminent domain after Kelo by going to http://castlecoalition.org, /legislative center. The Castle Coalition describes itself as citizens fighting eminent domain. So that shows you what their focus is. And their website has a lot of good information on this issue. So if you find out your state didn't protect you after Kelo, then my question would be, what are you waiting for? Start an initiative tomorrow to protect your property. It's never too late. And if it happened in other states, it can certainly happen in yours. Realize that you're probably not going to put a complete stop to eminent domain takings, but there are certainly some reasonable restrictions that can be placed on them. But let's step back for a moment and ask, where do we derive our right to even possess property? Let's make sure we have such a right. Exodus 20:15 states, "Thou shalt not kill unless you're the government." Well, actually, that's not an accurate translation of the Bible, as David will point out if I give him the chance, but it is an accurate reflection of reality today. By proscribing theft, God, in effect, says we have a right to possess things. Two verses later, we learn that it is not only should we not steal, we shouldn't even contemplate the stealing by coveting or desiring the things of others. So beyond the moral law, we also have civil laws against theft, and we can't legally take anything from each other. We likewise have no power to force people to sell us their property. So where does government, which ostensibly gets all its powers from the people, get the power to do so? If the people don't possess the power to take from one another, then how do we grant that power to our government? That's a question we should be asking and discussing among ourselves. The obvious answer makes eminent domain a bogus power, but I think most of us are willing to agree that government should have some eminent domain power under certain circumstances, certainly in wartime. The government needs the power to take things that are necessary for our common defense. Nevertheless, America has a great interstate highway system today. It has enormous airports which enable us to travel across the country in a matter of a few hours. It has giant sports complexes and forests of city skyscrapers, all because of eminent domain. Eminent domain has been a fixture of government since governments have been around, at least since the first monarchies. The term is derived from the Latin phrase meaning supreme lordship, and its roots go back to the time that kings had all the rights and their subjects had, well, none to speak of. Kings could and did take whatever they wanted from their subjects. In 1215, that all changed. Magna Carta placed restrictions on King John at the time that required for the first time that takings be compensated. But from the time our Constitution was ratified until well after the Civil War, legislators and judges refused to infer that there was a federal eminent domain power, whether takings from whether derived from Congress's enumerated powers or the necessary and proper clause or even the takings clause itself. They viewed eminent domain as a great power, quote, one that was too important to be left to implication. Well, this view died in 1875 when, in the case of Cole versus United States, the Supreme Court created the federal eminent domain power, subject to the restrictions of the Fifth Amendment, of course. 4 years later, in the case of Boone County versus Patterson, the Supreme Court announced that eminent domain, quote, requires no constitutional recognition. It is an attribute of sovereignty. Oh, really? Who decided that this was an attribute of sovereignty, we might add? Well, there's another question we need to discuss. We typically think of property in its tangible sense, something we can see and touch or take possession of, and this property is typically divided into real property, essentially immovable property, and personal property or movable property, but there's much, much more to the word property. In his famous 1792 essay on property, James Madison, quoting Blackstone, defined property as everything to which a man may attach a value and have a right. So it has to have some value, and we must have a right to it. In Madison's view, this includes such intangibles as our opinions and the free communication of them, our, quote, safety and liberty of our person. To Madison, conscience, he called the most sacred of all property. He saw a property in our rights and a property that government has a responsibility to protect. Government is instituted, quoting Madison now, government is instituted to protect property of every sort. This being the end of government, that alone is a just government which impartially secures to every man whatever is his own. That is not a just government, nor is property secure under it, where arbitrary restrictions, exemptions, and monopolies deny to part of its citizens that free use of their faculties and free choice of their occupations, which not only constitute their property in the general sense of the word, but are the means of acquiring property. He goes on to say, if there be a government which prides itself in maintaining the inviolability of property, which provides that none shall be taken directly even for public use without indemnification to the owner, and yet directly violates the property which individuals have in their opinions, their religion, their persons, and their faculties, such a government is not a pattern for the United States. So what have we become today? At what point does government's responsibility to protect the property of its citizens change and allow it to take that same property instead, or another property? And despite offers of just compensation, what should happen when someone just doesn't want to sell the home they grew up in, a home which, in their view, is priceless? Consider this as well. The Articles of Confederation Congress had no express power of eminent domain. It's just not there. And the Congress under the Articles of Confederation had only the powers expressly given to them in the document. They gave themselves that right, at least as regards the Northwest Territory, by passing the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which included an eminent domain provision. But that didn't make it proper. How can Congress give itself powers that the people don't wish it to have? In creating the general government in 1788, that we now have under the Constitution, the American people, probably without realizing it, gave away the sovereign, unfettered use of their property and gave it to this new government. They gave to this new government the power of eminent domain. So let's go back to the Takings Clause for a moment. Nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. We've heard that three times now. As a side note, it is interesting to note that not a single state suggested the inclusion of what became the Takings Clause in the Fifth Amendment. Many states sent in proposed articles, about 124 of them total, but James Madison added this particular clause on his own. According to Madison, government has a responsibility to protect even the intangible property of my rights. Does this mean that when government takes away anything that I currently have, am I entitled to be compensated for it? I'm just asking here. So if government takes a right of conscience from me, as was seen in Kim Davis's incident down in Kentucky, her right of conscience was certainly abridged. Does that mean she is entitled to be compensated for the taking of that right? I think that's another discussion that we could have. Here's one more thing to add to this whole discussion of eminent domain. Donald Trump thinks it's a neat idea, and a lot of people are upset about the fact that he is a businessman that has become what he is today largely through eminent domain and the takings that have resulted from that. So is either of you want to add anything to the discussion in the few seconds we've got left?
Well, yes, that whenever property is taken by the government, that's a very, very dangerous power, as I think both of you have pointed out, and a power that ought to be very clearly circumscribed, saying this is the only things that can be done with that power of eminent domain, because, as we know, human nature, given its fallen bent, is going to tend to expand and press against any fence or any boundary that's put up. But we've got a dangerous situation where Kilo v. New London, they've pushed the fence way back and said, unless there's some other restrictions imposed, they can basically take whatever they want for whatever reason they claim they need that property.
David, I hate to interrupt you, but we're going to take a short break and be right back to discuss this topic more appropriately.
right here in Philadelphia. Broadcasting freedom, shining light throughout the tri-state area. Streaming freedom, shining light from Philly to the nations. 1180 shining forth, we are the Freedom Station. WFYN.
News Radio. I'm Chris Foster. Hurricane Patricia is heading toward the Pacific coast of Mexico with maximum sustained winds nearly 200 miles an hour. It's the strongest ever recorded in this hemisphere. John Cangelosi at the National Hurricane Center.
Landfall's not far away. It's probably in the evening hours is probably the best bet, eastern time zone. This is a potentially really devastating scenario.
The storm's then expected to take a turn toward West Texas and areas already flooded. Hillary Clinton and other Democratic candidates speak at a women's forum today. She spent all yesterday and into the evening with the House panel investigating the consulate attack in Benghazi, Libya.
I've lost more sleep than all of you put together. I have been racking my brain about what more could have been done.
Some Republicans on that committee say she should have done more to protect the four Americans killed in the attack 3 years ago. Fox News, we report. You decide.
WFYL, King of Prussia, Philadelphia. Good morning. AM 1180 WFYL now begins its broadcast day. WFYL is owned and operated by Trinity Associates Broadcasting, LLC. WFYL operates on an assigned carrier frequency of 1180 kHz as authorized by the Federal Communications Commission. Streaming live online at 1180WFYL.com. If you have any questions or comments about our programming, call
610-539-1783. God bless America.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFYL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Welcome back to We the People, the Constitution Matters. We're examining the question of the constitutionality of the U.S. government taking private property, or even state governments or local governments for that matter, taking private property for public use. When is it justified and when not? And in a few minutes, we'll be taking your questions and calls, so I ask you to get them ready. And remember, the call-in numbers are 610-539-TALK. That's 610-539-8255. 610-539-1783 or 610-539-1784. David Whitney is a senior instructor at the Institute on the Constitution in Pasadena, Maryland, which conducts classes on the Constitution all around the country. David, we heard a little bit about your view of this before the break. You want to add anything to those comments? What is your view of eminent domain? Is it ever justified?
In very, very rare examples, is it justified? Let me just give you the background a bit of why our founders were so concerned about this, because they had experienced the King George III, taking their property. And so when you read the 27 complaints listed in the Declaration of Independence, one is this, that the King George III has erected a multitude of new officers and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. He has combined with others to subject us to imposing taxes on us without our consent. So they saw King George III taking their property through unjust taxation and through all kinds of regulation. Wow, boy, that sounds very modern, very much like what we're experiencing right now. And John Adams, signer of both documents and second president, he said this regarding property. And he said, the moment the idea is admitted into society that property is not as sacred as the laws of God, anarchy and tyranny commence. Property must be secured or liberty cannot exist. So I think you couldn't be clearer than what John Adams was stating, that we need to protect property of all kinds. As Madison, I think, rightly pointed out, we have more than just physical property. There are intangibles that are our property as well. And they said the whole purpose for which civil government exists, the whole reason and therefore its aim, is to secure our God-given right to property that we have in and of ourselves. So with the power of eminent domain, it's a very dangerous power, but the argument we're given many, many times, and the argument there in Kelo v. New London is, well, this is going to benefit the society in ways that are going to benefit everyone. Everyone's going to benefit because we're doing some urban redevelopment, and that's quite often the case with eminent domain, is urban redevelopment is promised. We're going to get rid of the blight, we're going to get rid of the ghetto, and so forth and so on. And I'm glad you referred to the Castle Coalition, because I refer people there as well to an article that illustrates the great damage done by eminent domain with the idea that somehow we're going to use eminent domain to revitalize an inner city. And the article there is Baltimore's Flawed Renaissance, a rather lengthy article, but it details exactly what the use of eminent domain accomplished in Baltimore. If you visit Baltimore today, you'll see the Inner Harbor is beautiful. There's two enormous stadiums for the Ravens and the Orioles, built at taxpayers' expense and maintained at taxpayers' expense. And then the Inner Harbor with the National Aquarium, and just very beautiful place to visit and tour. And yet there's another Baltimore, the one that you saw in the Baltimore riots, where Baltimore is one of the murder capitals in our country, and street violence and blight is everywhere. So there's this two sides of Baltimore, and that article rightly argues, I believe, that eminent domain and the use of eminent domain is the reason that Baltimore is such a failed city today. It's a failed city because what eminent domain communicated, as it was used by the political powers in Baltimore to take people's property in order to build the Inner Harbor, in order to build the stadiums, in order to do all the wonderful things, they communicated something very clear to the people who own property in Baltimore, and that is, you don't own your property. Anytime the city wants to come along and take your property, bulldoze your house, and, well, you know, we just maybe put up a parking lot, which is one of the eminent domain powers the city of Baltimore has. Anytime that takes place, you communicate to the citizens, you don't actually own your property. And the result of that communication over the decades is that Baltimore had a flight of everybody who could possibly leave the city, leaving the city, moving to the suburbs, and establishing property that they could actually own, that they could actually possess. And what it left behind was an urban mess. Drug dealers, pimps, prostitutes, and a mess in that city that is an unsolvable mess because the people who made that city great are gone. They're gone because those people valued hard work and they valued property. These were not the welfare people. These are the people who were actively productive citizens in society. They fled because they realized the city of Baltimore was aiming at stealing their property. It was just a matter of time before they took their property for whatever reason the city determined in its mind was the best use of that property. And so I think Baltimore illustrates the great danger that eminent domain poses, because when you attack property rights, as John Adams said, what commences as soon as you attack property rights is anarchy and tyranny. So tyranny of the government determining that you don't own any property whatsoever. That article also has a very interesting sidelight that you might think is quite outrageous in terms of the extent to which the government and the whole state of Maryland viewed its power of eminent domain. Many people in our state just hate the Colts, that football team that left in the middle of the night. But the backstory that is not told is the reason the Colts bolted out of Baltimore in the middle of the night, took the, you know, the city and the state's favorite football heroes, they did so because of eminent domain. The one house, the House of Delegates, had already voted, and the Senate was poised to vote the next day to take that football franchise, the Baltimore Colts, take it away from the owner of the Baltimore Colts and possess it for the benefit and the ownership of the state of Maryland. They were going to steal the property of a football team owned by, I forget who the particular owner was, and the only way around the state of Maryland stealing the Baltimore Colts was for them to give no warning whatsoever, to pack up their team and move to Indianapolis, which is what they did. However, the media, of course, complicit with the eminent domain evil, they would not really report on this is what was happening. Rather, they reported, oh, what a terrible owner, what a terrible team. We hate the Colts because they bolted from our state in the middle of the night. But they did so because they recognized, just as the homeowners in Baltimore recognized, the government was an enemy to liberty, an enemy to property, and the only safe thing you could do with someone who's an enemy to liberty and enemy to property is get yourself as far away from their greedy, graspy hands that were intending to steal your property. So we need to see the downside of eminent domain, and that needs to be highlighted with people so that they recognize if we permit any government taking, it ought to be extremely restricted. There ought to be high-level proof that that property is actually needed, whether it's to build a road or put up a school or something that, you know, we would say is beneficial to the community. By the way, I don't think schools are really beneficial to the community, so there shouldn't be, in my opinion, any taking to build a school. But perhaps a road, in occasion, needs to have a certain property that is going to be taken. So very rarely should we allow eminent domain to take place. In fact, I think that the process should be difficult and onerous such that we restrict the eminent domain powers, both for the federal, state, and the local governments, to a very, very limited list of potential takings of property.
Well, that's a great example from Baltimore. It doesn't look like we have any callers yet. Oh, we do have perhaps one caller. A Jim Piper from Chesapeake, Virginia, has joined us. Why don't we take his call and then see where that discussion leads us? But I also want to get into some of the other abuses, besides the Baltimore case, other abuses of eminent domain. There are many that we could discuss. So let's put Jim Piper on the line and see what his question is. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. Yes, the question I have concerns, and I was personally involved, my children's school, Greenbrier Christian Academy, had an issue with when they expanded Kempsville Road, they wanted to take more of the parking lot and everything of Greenbrier Christian Academy. Now, it actually went to court because, you know, I was involved with it. I wasn't allowed on the jury. But how do you determine how much is just compensation? Is it just, you know, like for real estate, you know, they get a survey or something done? How do you determine what is just compensation?
Well, that's a great question, and I don't know that there's a definitive answer for it. I mean, it certainly has to do something with comparative sales of like property in the area, et cetera, et cetera. But here's an example for you. Out in Nevada, and this is very near and dear to me, there's in the Nevada test site, there's a very sensitive, highly classified area called Groom Lake. And, I mean, the name is not classified, but the fact of what goes on there is classified. And there's a mine that has been in the Sheehan family since the early 1800s, I believe, that overlooks, because it's on high ground, it overlooks the Groom Lake area. And with the right kind of optics, you could probably take a look at what's going on there. Well, the government, specifically my Air Force, has just this week taken the property of the Sheehan family, because they turned down an offer of $5.2 million for this mine, not just the facilities above ground, but the ore as well that is underground. It's a silver mine. And so they decided that $5.2 million was insufficient given the potential value of the ore they could extract. And they turned down the offer. So what did the government do? What did the Air Force do in reply? It just condemned the property and took it. And so now their family is out not only their $5.2 million potential buyout, but they're out every penny. And now they're figuring out what to do. That's just another example. So in the case of Greenbrier, how do they determine what the proper value of that portion of property they wanted to take to expand the road? I don't know, but consider this. I mean, if someone was born in a house, grew up in that house, their family lived in that house all their life, what is the value? What is the value of that home? Is it whatever the home next door sold for, or is there an intrinsic value to that property that we can't just put a dollar sign on?
Gary, I think that's why these cases, Jim, you're referring to a case that went to court, that indeed we really shouldn't trust the government's valuation, saying, you know, there's some intangibles here that need to be argued in court, and we're essentially then trusting a jury of our peers, 12 peers, who would say, we hear these arguments and we understand what's taking place here, and we're trying to put ourselves in their shoes, which is exactly what Jesus instructed us to do, that do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So the jury sitting in court can try to put themselves in the view of a property owner to say, what would be fair and just compensation in the eyes of that person sitting in that position if I were in their shoes, which is truly how a juror ought to think about making that decision, and hopefully a decision that would render justice to the individual. But in some senses, you cannot render complete justice, because what if the individual doesn't want to leave their house, period? I mean, Kilo, she wanted to have the property where it was. Ultimately, there was a deal done where her house was actually picked up and moved to a new location, and she no longer lived in that house. She didn't want to live in that house. She wanted it where it was originally. So there's intangibles that are even unmeasurable in terms of their valuation.
Can I make a point here about jury members?
We do have one other caller on the line, so go ahead, Phil.
Okay, it'll be brief. When you have the general welfare idea where society benefits, how do you select jury members who will not see themselves as benefiting from the taking of the property? So how much independence do you really have there even in the jury system?
Well, that's a great question. And how do you determine whether that juror, the potential juror, could not benefit in any way? If it's going to be public benefit and that juror is part of the public, then certainly by default they're going to benefit just because of the way we define those terms. We've got Keith on the line from Chesterfield, Virginia. He's got a question about the tax situation, and that, you know, Phil mentioned earlier that there are other ways to look at this government taking question, and taxes is certainly one. So let's put Keith on the line and see what his question is. Keith, how are you this morning?
Fine, thanks. How are you?
Great.
My question has to do more with real estate. A few years back, I paid off my house, and that's when it really hit me. I realized I don't really own this home. I'm the equivalent of a serf from the Middle Ages. I'm renting my home from Chesterfield County, because if I don't pay the taxes on that real estate property, they'll take my home. You know, once you've paid off a home, it hits you that, you know, actually paying a tax on this place, it's not just something I do regularly as a house payment to the bank. And I just feel like it's an unjust tax. You know, it's so commonly done and everybody accepts it. Nobody really thinks about it. But, you know, one of the things that brought it home to me was I also was downsized out of a job, and my income really, really is a lot lower. And what used to be not a big deal, you know, coming up with a couple $1,000s a year to pay real estate taxes is a large, it's a big deal now.
And it's coming due this month, next month, I think.
Because I feel like, you know, I could really survive quite easily with my house paid off, but that's a large portion of my income now.
It is, and it comes along with the distinction we have. There are two different types of title.
To have our
you take title to land.
It's not really owned. It's not mine.
Yeah, because in Virginia, at least, you buy land with a fee simple title, and you don't take ultimate and total possession of that land. In some states, you can purchase land through allodial title, and that does give you the ability to own it outright without taxation or property taxes. But Virginia is not an allodial title state, so you don't really have a remedy there. It's a great point, and unfortunately, we use the term, I'm going to go buy that property, and we think that we're going to buy it like we buy a refrigerator. Property is just not handled that way. We don't buy that property and have exclusive use of it. So it's a great point, and as Phil pointed out, that's another example of taking that we could probably spend a whole show talking about, this whole idea of real estate taxes, and what are we going to do with this? Is this the situation we want to live with as American citizens, or should we propose some other solution? What would be your proposed solution, Keith, if you wanted to do away with if you wanted to correct the situation in your view?
Well, I guess I just feel like, under the point of government taking, when there's a tax like this, you don't have a choice. They're going to get it one way or the other, by force if necessary. I feel like taxes should be somehow tied to a voluntary transaction, or at least a transaction you can decide I will or will not purchase. And I guess that sort of amounts to sales taxes rather than taxing something merely because it exists. I mean, I just feel like an income tax is equally immoral. That's my time. That's my property. I spent time making that money, and now they're taking. You're not really, and in that sense, you're a slave. You're sort of an indentured servant. I'd rather the taxes be tied to some sort of transaction that at least I can say I don't want to buy it.
Right. Phil or David, do you have any view of this?
Well, let me take a crack at this. I think the basic problem here is the size of government. If you look at the charter that government gets through constitutions and these kinds of documents, it's very limited. For example, if you look at the adequate budget for those things that are constitutional in the federal government, my suspicion is that we're dealing with something like 10% of the actual budget that we have today. And so, we're always going to have this problem about government taking in some way, as long as we acknowledge the need for government. But on the other hand, the key here, and we have to really focus on this, the key is to limit the scope of government to its original intention.
Right. I agree wholeheartedly. We're approaching $20 trillion worth of official debt and probably more than $100 trillion of unfulfilled obligations. So this is a problem that the American people need to really grapple with. We need to have some discussions about this. But we're not, unfortunately, people who are brave enough, I'll use that term, to take on these kinds of discussions, because sometimes we know where they're going to lead, and it doesn't lead to an easy, nice, clean solution. David, were you going to add to that?
Yes, Keith, you're hitting on a point that's much larger, and it really is who owns the land. And yes, your point, I think, is well taken. We're in a system of government today where the government claims it owns the land, and only we can be a renter or a serf on the government's land. And if we don't pay the rent, or if we don't abide by whatever restrictions, zoning codes, whatever they put upon us, they can come and push us off the property that is really not our property at all. It's theirs. And this comes back to the really big idea that government, civil government, owns no property whatsoever. In our founders' understanding and the biblical understanding, which is even more important, Leviticus 25, that property belongs within the realm of family government, not civil government, not church government, but family government owns the land in chapter 25 of Leviticus. It owns it in perpetuity. God gives the land, and by the way, that's where that phrase allodial is, the Greek phrase, but from God, that I got my land but from God, and therefore I have a right to this land. Nobody can take this land from me. Nobody can kick me off this land, and therefore I don't have to pay any taxes on the land. So to return to that standard you're speaking of, we need to change the thinking of American people about property, that property doesn't belong to government, civil government. Property instead belongs in family government. And as Leviticus 25 points out, even if the family is impoverished and they have to take a loan out or even temporarily sell the property at the year of Jubilee, that property comes back to the original family that God gave that property to, and therefore nobody can permanently own it other than the family. And that's an understanding, I think, that if we teach and gain a groundswell of support for, we can push government off the property that does not belong to it and return the property to the rightful owner, and that is the family as God has designed it.
Hey, Keith, make sure you stay on the line after the show and give them your mailing address. I certainly want to mail you a nice pocket constitution for being a first-time caller, so thank you very much for that question. We've got about a little more than 2 minutes left in the show, and does that answer your question, Keith?
Yeah, those are some good ideas, and I totally agree with the comments. We just got a lot of work to do, though, to change of thinking.
We do have a lot of work to do. That's exactly right. That sums it up very well. We've got a lot of work to do as a people, and we've got to have some conversations that we are avoiding and that are not going to be pleasant and you know, are going to take us places intellectually where we don't seem to want to go, but there are conversations we nevertheless need to have. Phil, any last words on this?
Yeah, I just would like to point out that the first three articles of the Constitution deal with explicit vesting of power, which is the way things should be done. But when we get into terms like necessary and proper, public use, and general welfare and so forth, we're into that jungle called implied vesting powers, where you arbitrarily, you give arbitrary powers to public officials, and that's just an invitation to immense corruption.
Right. And this is a discussion that we need to have. The American people have don't realize it, but we have departed from the original intent of government in this country. As David has pointed out, we have lost our biblical view of government that we need to recapture, and the only way to do it is to have these conversations across the country. I just want to kind of close the show out with this quote of James Madison. It comes from that same essay on property. As a man is said to have a right to his property, he may be equally said to have a property in his rights. Where an excessive power prevails, property of no sort is duly respected. No man is safe in his opinions, his person, his faculties, or his possessions. Keep that in mind, and we'll see you next week on We the People, the Constitution Matters. Bring somebody new with you when you join us. See ya.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.